Good afternoon, and welcome to House Labor and Commerce. It is 3:19 p.m. It is Monday, March 5th, and members present are Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Stutes, Representative Knopf, Representative Birch, Representative Josephson, Vice Chair Wool, and myself, Chair Quito. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Susie Edwardson is our recording secretary this afternoon, and Ben Manley is our LIO moderator. We have three bills before us. House bill, and I've changed the order a little bit just to make for some efficiencies in doing some of the work that we have to do today. House Bill 353, Marital and Family Therapy Licensing Services in the first hearing. House Bill 277, Broadband Internet Neutrality Regulation in its second hearing. Intent is to try and move that bill on towards its next destination. House Bill 309, Rejecting Officers' Compensation Commission Report, and I will be stepping down as chair for that bill because I have a proposal that I'd like to propose or present to the committee and don't want there to be any confusion about my role in doing that as myself. So with that, I would like to bring House Bill 353 before us, Marital and Family Therapy License Services, and we've got Bernice Nisbet, staff to Representative Sponholz, and as we heard this morning, Representative Sponholz is recovering from an illness, and so we wish her quick recovery and hope to see her back here as quickly as possible. So with that, Ms. Nisbet.
Thank you, members of the committee, Chair Quito. For the record, Bernice Nisbet, staff to Representative Ivy Sponholz. I am here today to provide you with the technical aspects of HB 353. As you know, the sponsor of the bill cannot be here today, and I know that she wishes she could, and she actually may be tuning in via gavel to gavel. So with that being said, I'd like to talk to you about HB 353. In front of you should be 30-LS1425/A. And some of you may be thinking, so what is a marital and family therapist, or what is marital and family therapy? MFTs treat serious clinical issues, including depression, anxiety, individual psychological problems, and child and parent difficulties. MFTs are mental health professionals trained in psychotherapy and family systems and are licensed to diagnose and treat mental and emotional disorders within the context of marriage, family, and couple systems. So there are four main things that HB 353 does. It first requires that 1,500 hours are supervised by a supervisor who is qualified. Of those 1,500 hours, 100 hours are individual supervision and 100 hours are group supervision. Of these 200 hours, they must be supervised by, or they can be supervised by more than one supervisor. The second thing that it does is that it specifies that a qualified supervisor for individual supervision must have 5 years of experience in family and marital therapy.
Ms. Nisbet, yes. We have a question from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Sure.
I apologize. I see the answer to my question right there. Sorry
okay.
about that.
Thank you. Can you continue, please?
Okay. Sorry.
So where did I leave off? So a qualified supervisor who is supervising for individual supervision has to have 5 years of experience in family and marital and family therapy and licensed to practice. Or if they're supervising for group supervision, they have to have a license, and they can have a license in other professional mental health professionals. Or they can be other professional mental health clinicians. So that would be an LPC, which is a licensed professional counselor, an LMFT, which is a licensed marital and family therapist, LCSW, which is a licensed clinical social worker, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and an advanced nurse practitioner. The third thing that it does is it defines what direct supervision is. So direct supervision is one or more psychiatrists on site 30% of the time. It also defines mental health physician clinic, which is it's a clinic that's operated by one or more psychiatrists, and they primarily provide mental health services. And then it also defines a psychiatrist, which is a person who is licensed to practice as a physician under AS08.64. And then the last thing that it does, and probably the most important thing, is that it allows the Department of Health and Social Services to reimburse for mental health services performed by a mental health clinician who is under the direct supervision of a psychiatrist. So with that, I'd like to go into the sectional analysis. And you'll recognize that each of the four objectives basically are the first four sections. So section one impacts AS08.63.100 subsection A. And so this is where in the bill the language says that 1,500 hours must be supervised. Of those 1,500 hours, 200 can be supervised by more than one supervisor. Section two is where it talks about how if a supervisor is supervising individual supervision, they need to have a license and they need to have more than 5 years or at least 5 years of marital and family therapy. And then if they are supervising for group supervision, they can have a license in as an LPC, an LMFT, a psychiatrist, an advanced nurse practitioner, a psychologist, or an LCSW. Section 3 impacts AS47.07.030 subsection B. And this is where marital and family therapist services are added to the Medicaid services that the department can reimburse for. And Section 4 impacts AS47.07.030 subsection G. And this is new language. And this just changes how direct supervision is defined. So it's one or more psychiatrists on site 30% of the time. It also defines mental health clinician, and it also defines a psychiatrist. Section 5 is a new section. It impacts AS4707.030 subsection H. And this is where the department can reimburse for mental health services provided by a psychiatrist or a mental health clinician licensed as an LPC, an LMFT, an MD, an ANNP, and an LCSW. Section 6 is where the department and the board will adopt the regulations that are in this bill. And Section 7 only impacts Section 6, which says that it'll be effective immediately. And then the last section, Section 8, says the effective date is January 1st, 2019. So before we move on to invited testimony, I just wanted to take a second to talk about some of the ideas that have come forth since this bill has been introduced. Caitlin, I believe, has a document that I'd like her to pass out, but some of the suggestions are asking that we redefine direct supervision as one or more psychiatrists on site 30% of the time, or they're available via communication device. And I just wanted to take a second to talk about the communication device term. I think a stakeholder has come forth and said that maybe adding telehealth instead of a communication device would be more definitive, because communication device is not defined in Alaska statutes. It is mentioned in Alaska statutes 47.05.270 under the provision for It's defined in the dental hygienist and assistance statutes, but it's mentioned, but it's not defined. So we were thinking that having it say telehealth would be all-encompassing. The other suggestion was allowing advanced nurse practitioners who have been approved by the Board of Nursing as a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner to provide mental health services, in addition to having psychiatrists be allowed to supervise. And then the last suggestion was changing mental health physician clinic to simply mental health clinic. So in the room, we have John Zezada. I believe the Alaska Board of Marital and Family Therapists are online, and then the department is also here to answer any questions.
We've got a question for Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, for the staff, what is prompting this legislation? And the reason I ask is, at first blush, it looks like someone thinks that marriage and family therapists, and we've just on the House floor today extended the commission or board's authorization for, I think, 8 years, that they need more oversight. And I know that there are all these other subsets of mental health counselor that you've noted, LPA, LPC, LCSW. Why is this one being sort of treated in this way?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, are you talking specifically about LMFTs?
Yes.
I might defer that question to John Zezada, or if one of the board members are online, maybe they could answer that question.
Thank you, Bernice. The people we have online right now are Randall Birds, Director, Division of Behavioral Health, and Nick Calsat. Dorothy Goddard Al-Aguero from the Chair of Board of Marital and Family Therapy. So, Ms. Goddard Aguero, can you provide an answer to Representative Justice's question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Could you, I was just able to join in, repeat the question?
Yes, so through the chair, so I'm familiar with the range of, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, but sort of the alphabet soup of different titles that make up mental health practitioners, and I'm wondering why marital and family therapists are the feature of this bill. Is it because someone alleged, or there's a belief that marital and family therapists are not being properly trained and supervised? Why is this bill here?
let's see. I'm fairly new to the board, and I'm a public member. This is Dorothy Goddard. This question is being addressed to me. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. My understanding was to clarify the requirements to define who could be a supervisor and also who would be allowed to participate in group supervision, because there's requirements for individual supervision and group supervision. And we have very few members. We have about, I think it's 87 licensed mm-hmm. marriage and family therapists. We're hoping to expand the availability of supervisors. I probably don't have the whole history of this bill. I've only been on the board for a year and a half, but I don't know if that answers your question.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Representative Joseph. And I actually have been informed that Mr. Cezada is with us in the room, and so maybe we can have him come forward. He just was not identified on our list of people. Mr. Sada, go ahead and come forward.
Good afternoon.
For the record, place your name and affiliation on the record and see if...
Yes, good afternoon. My name is John Zezada. I'm the policy director for the Alaska Primary Care Association. We are the Association of Alaska's Federally Qualified Health Centers. There are 27 federally qualified health centers, also known as community health centers, operating at 160 sites throughout the state. We support House Bill 353 and the leadership of Rep. Sponholz in addressing this important need to expand behavioral health services. And we also appreciate the support of Senators Geisel and Wilson in their companion bills. Expanding billable behavioral health labor force is the number one priority for Alaska health centers for the last 2 years. Health centers in Alaska have made major investments in behavioral health integration with whole person care in primary care settings that have resulted over the last 2 to 3 years in a 25% increase in providers, encounters, and patients served. Over 11,000 Alaskans now get primary behavioral health services in community health centers. And the problem is that there is a shortage of billable providers. We did a labor force survey late last year. We discovered that Alaska's community health centers currently have a shortage of up to 18 full-time equivalent behavioral health providers. Some of those positions have been open for as long as a year. At a conservative estimate, we believe that we could serve an additional 9,000 Alaskans if our labor force was full. Currently, health centers can only bill Medicaid under the federally qualified health center bundled rate for behavioral health encounters made by an MD or a psychiatrist, a licensed PhD level psychologist, or an LCSW. Health centers also employ licensed marital and family therapists and licensed professional counselors, but they cannot bill Medicaid. They are paid through earned revenue and the federal health center grants. Health centers continue to attract additional investment in behavioral health and substance abuse treatment from the federal government with the goal of serving more patients in comprehensive care settings. In 2016, an additional $3.4 million flowed into Alaska health centers under the access increases for mental health and substance abuse services from the federal government. The majority of these funds would be spent on hiring additional providers. But at this time, those funds are not sustainable because additional provider types are not billable under Medicaid. With the recently passed 2-year federal community health center authorization and new federal funding for addressing the opioid epidemic, community health centers in Alaska and around the nation expect additional direction and financial incentives from the federal government to continue to develop these services and hire additional clinicians. LMFTs are a good match for serving integrated primary care settings with medical providers, caring for patients through timely interventions, short-term therapy, and collaborating with both nurse practitioner prescribers and care coordinators. Their training in both counseling and their worldview of the patient in the context of their family is a useful match. We did have two particular items in the bill that we wanted to reference in Section 2, and this is being taken up currently under in deliberations on SB 105 and SB 169. We would like to broaden the definition of a supervisor to include physicians and including primary care MDs. These are the predominant supervising types in Alaska community health centers. And finally, in Section 4, we would seek additional clarification that the mental health physician clinic or the mental health clinic allows primary care federally qualified health centers to benefit from this provider type expansion. And with that, I'm happy to try and address some questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Representative Sullivan Leonard?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Sazada, are you a physician at the clinic? Okay. Could you give a little more information on what you were just talking about on Section 2 for the amendment that you're seeking regarding oversight, not just only by psychiatrists, but primary care physician or what have you?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard. We're seeking and this came through with the other two bills that are working their way right now. We want a broader supervision type than the psychiatrist that's named, you know, in this bill. And as we think right now, there's a an amendment, you know, in Senate Bill 169 that would address this as well. What requiring a psychiatrist does in a primary care setting is create an additional bottleneck to care. To have a psychiatrist, you know, on staff, you know, for even one third of a time can cost well over $100,000 a year. It's not a way that you know, care is most frequently provided in a federally qualified health center. And we do also agree, you know, that, you know, in Senate Bill 169 that suggests having a nurse practitioner be an eligible supervisor type, that can work also.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is it not concerning to you that when you talk about expanding the realm of supervisors to general practitioners or nurse practitioners, psychology and psychiatry is a specialized field that requires a whole completely different level of education and training, and now you're asking that these LMFTs to be supervised by somebody who doesn't have any background in that. Is that not a little concerning?
And I am, through the chair, Representative Knopp, I am not a expert on new supervision of behavioral health provider types, but the family practice physician, you know, has a level of, you know, behavioral health supervision, you know, in their training, and it is a best practice in other states that have, you know, made this change.
So, follow up. So then, I guess, and I got to apologize because I haven't read it thoroughly time and time again. I've done a brief review, but in the presentation, and so, well, here's my, I'll just tell you, here's my deal, you know, with $100 million Medicaid expansion supplemental budget this year, and now you're asking us to put a bunch more people eligible to bill for them services, and you're down to, and I'm not sure what these LM licensed marriage family therapists, what their background training is, other than I see 100 hours of individual supervision, 100 hours of group supervision, and you know, and so in reality that's 3 weeks worth of training at 40 hours a week, you know, and the 1500 hours, that's 10 months worth, you know, when I know some of them people are in school for years. So, and I understand the oversight and the supervision. I just think we're opening the door here to a mess. I'll just be honest with you, you know. So,
Ms. Nesbitt.
Through the chair, Rep. Knopp. So LMFTs have to have a master's degree or a PhD to practice, and they have to have 1,500 hours total of supervision. And that equates to about 2 years before they can get their license. They have to also pass an examination, and the board has to approve them, and they have to have a clean record.
Okay, thank you for that.
Okay, Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of this stuff makes sense, I think, and I, having myself worked and many family members worked in the behavioral health industry, if you want to call it, I realized that psychiatrists are in short demand, and a lot of what I guess my question is this: in the world of family therapy, it's a broad question, but is as much of the therapy sort of talk therapy, and much of it is medical, you know, prescription based therapy, or is it a combination thereof? I assume if there's not a psychiatrist on premise that they can still, someone has prescription powers, right? If someone needs an antidepressant or something like that, is that the kind of therapy this is? Or is it, it's a broad question, I realize, but I think you think of family therapy, you think of more like counseling sessions as opposed to prescription types of things.
So through the chair, Representative Wall, in a community health center, the trend has been to integrate, you know, the medical and the behavioral care in one site. So within a care team, you would very likely have an MD. You would likely have a physician assistant. You would potentially have a nurse practitioner, a prescribing nurse practitioner, and potentially a licensed clinical social worker. And in this new case, you would be able to add an LMFT. And the idea would be that as a patient appoints, whether it's primarily for a behavioral health issue or if they're coming in for a physical ailment, hypertension and diabetes are the most common in Alaska health centers, that also had a co-occurring behavioral health issue, that could either benefit from a short-term intervention, counseling, or medical management. You're able to provide all of that in one visit. And not to go too deeply into this, but the bundled rate that is negotiated for federally qualified health centers enables you to do all of that in one visit at a lower cost. And as we as we seek to address cost, having additional types of providers that may be at less cost in the market because there are more, helps control the cost of care overall.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you for your questions. Thank you for your testimony. And we will go on to public testimony. public testimony is open at 3:46 p.m. And we have one person signed up at this point, Albert Wall. Mr. Wall, if you could provide us with your name, affiliation, and your testimony, please.
My name is Albert Wall. I am the CEO of Peninsula Community Health Services in Kenai. We are a federally qualified health center and part of the Primary Care Association.
Thank you, and go ahead with your testimony.
I would like to make a clarification statement or two regarding licensed marriage and family therapists and their the services that they provide and how they bill. There is currently a way for licensed marriage and family therapists to bill through Medicaid. They bill, they can bill as a master's level clinician through a community mental health center that is a grantee of the state. And so there is a method for them to bill Medicaid. The reimbursement rate on the rehabilitation side of the house is very poor. So many of them do not. However, there is a way for them to do it. I say that because this discussion about supervision really isn't about opening up the floodgates and having a bunch of more clinicians billing Medicaid. What this discussion is about is the bottleneck that we have in the field of behavioral health with the required oversight for those clinicians. Right now, oversight is limited to a psychiatrist, and there are simply not enough of those to go around in the state to provide oversight for clinicians. I would like to echo what John said earlier in that I strongly support something along the lines of an advanced nurse practitioner with psychiatric specialty being added in that capacity. They do have specialized training in that area, and adding them to the, giving them the capacity to supervise in a clinical setting would bring more providers to the table and take some of the burden off the smaller providers in the state right now. Because what's happening is most small clinics don't have the money to hire a full-time psychiatrist. And so as the regulations are written, they are required to have 30% oversight of a psychiatrist for their program. It's not necessarily a matter of him individually, clinically supervising each already licensed professional underneath of him, as it is, or her, as it is a matter of signing off on what they have done in order to allow them to be billed, to have that service be billed. And right now, many smaller providers are contracting out 30% of a psychiatrist at a very high rate to come into their organization on, like I said, a 30% time to sign off on paperwork and then go on to the next provider and do the same thing. And if they had, and psychiatrists are extremely expensive and hard to find. So if an advanced nurse practitioner with psychiatric specialty was allowed to do that same thing, it would free up a number of providers who are, by the way, a little cheaper to pay than a psychiatrist, and reduce the administrative and financial burden on the clinic so that they can provide more services for the same, for less money, basically. So that's the clarification statement I would have.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. And I do actually have a question for you. This is Chair Kito. Thinking about when you have supervision of a person that is being signed off for in order to become a licensed marital and family therapist, I can understand the psychiatrist role because a psychiatrist has had to go through supervision in order to get to the level that they are. The same thing with a psychologist, the same thing with other therapist classes. I am a little confused, I guess, about a psychiatric nurse practitioner and whether or not they have gone through an oversight process that has them being supervised for therapy, because I am concerned that if we have individuals that just have a mental health credential, doesn't necessarily mean they have mental health therapy knowledge or experience or would be qualified to sign off on mental health therapy experience for that person to become a licensed individual. And can you address that concern, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So just in our organization, I'll give you an example. We do have, our chief medical officer is a psychiatrist, and we are one of the lucky few providers in the state that we have a full-time psychiatrist on staff. That is very beneficial to us. We are also a dually hatted organization, meaning we fall under two separate sets of regulations. On one hand, we are a federally qualified health center, which John's out in the room at the Primary Care Association represents. On the other hand, we are also a Division of Behavioral Health grantee, and so I do have master's level clinicians, including LMFTs, that can bill Medicaid underneath our psychiatrist signature, but they bill on the rehab side of the house, not on the medical side of the house. I also have on staff two advanced nurse practitioners with psychiatric specialty, and so when this idea of this bill came up, I sat down with those three, the psychiatrist and the two A&P psychs, and had a discussion with them as to what their comfort level was as to this bill. And my discussion with them, I found out that indeed the A&P psychs do, as part of their specialty, have that oversight built into it, much like a psychiatrist does, but not, they're not the supervising one. They go through the modalities that they learn, the therapy modalities that the clinicians are employing. And I'm much more comfortable with them, A&P psychs speaking of, having oversight capacity of a marriage and family therapist than I would be perhaps another physician who did not have that education or knowledge. Because they do have, you know, direct contact with therapy modalities, evidence-based practice, and clinical work in that regard.
So I guess maybe just a follow-up to my question, do they actually provide therapy services, or are they just educated in therapy modalities?
They can provide therapy services. However,
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Like I said, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, they can provide therapy services. However, most of them do not, because they tend to bill at the top end of their licensure. I know that when a patient comes in for a med management meeting with their advanced nurse practitioner psychiatric and they are prescribing medication for them, they often do therapy with them at that time because the patient needs that. They're billing for med management, but in practice they're doing some therapy at the same time.
And I guess that's kind of the question, the concern for me. One of the things that I think of is so a psychologist probably has to demonstrate a certain number of hours of supervised oversight in therapy, and I don't know that a psychologist or that we as the state of Alaska would accept that perhaps a licensed marriage and family therapist could sign off on the therapy hours of a psychologist and still have a licensed psychologist. There are some details there I think I just have some questions about.
Mr. Chair, I don't think the bill is asking for American Family Therapists to be able to sign off on hours. Perhaps I heard you wrong.
Well, no, I guess the question is that their therapy is being signed off by another professional. I'm just trying to understand the knowledge and experience of the people that we are authorizing to sign off to understand whether they've had to go through a similar process themselves in order to effectively sign off on those therapy hours. And so that's the question I'm trying to get resolved.
I understand.
Okay. Representative Josephson has a question.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I guess I'm sensing that what this bill is trying to achieve is to expand the number of mental health practitioners that can bill for Medicaid-eligible behavioral health services. And the target is LMFT, so presumably there's some rule apparently that says they need X number of supervised hours. Apparently they don't have those hours. And I guess, I mean, that's sort of what I've gleaned. And I guess my question is, does that mean that the LPAs, LPCs, LCSWs, Masters of Counseling, all of those folks do not have a lack of supervised hours? And so you're trying to, is that what's going on? You're trying to grow the population that can bill?
Through the chair, this is not about supervision of client hours. There's two different types of supervision we're discussing. What you're talking about when a LMFT, which I have been a licensed marriage and family therapist before, and I have let my license lapse because I'm a fairly lousy licensed marriage and family therapist, but when you are going for licensure, you receive 1,500 hours of oversight in the training that you've done, where your trainers will watch you do your therapy and educate you as to how to improve. That is not the type of oversight that we're talking about with this bill. The supervision that we're talking about with this bill is entirely separate. They're not supervising hours for a clinician to get better at what they're doing and approve of what they're doing. They're supervising the actual clinical work, which they've done only for submission of a billing process. The regulations are written so that for a licensed provider to bill Medicaid, they have to have oversight. It doesn't have anything to do with their licensure or the individual sessions that they're doing with clients. It has to do with the signature authority of an individual to submit the bill on their behalf. So the supervision that we are talking about right now is right just with a psychiatrist. They're the only people that can do that. And the problem is that there's so few of them that the clinicians that work underneath those psychiatrists can't do the work that they're trained to do and bill for it through Medicaid because there's not enough people in the state to provide them oversight, or the people that are there are too expensive to provide their organization oversight. Is that clear? Is that more clear?
Somewhat. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Wall? Seeing no questions, thank you for your testimony. I do not have anybody else signed up to testify on House Bill 353 at this time. Ms. Nesbitt? Is there anybody else you would like to bring forward?
Through the chair, or Chair Keto, I guess that's it.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Nesbitt. What I will do at this point, we'll leave public testimony open, set this bill aside, and we will address it at a future meeting. With that, I will bring House Bill 277 back before committee. And we can have Mr. Garish come forward. Mr. Garish, please place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with a reintroduction of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Kito and the rest of the committee. My name is Jacob Garish, staff to Representative Scott Kawasaki. House Bill 277 would require internet service providers, ISPs, who provide broadband internet to Alaskan families engage in the practice of net neutrality. The bill would make sure that all data on the internet is treated equally. It would protect small businesses from uncompetitive practices and guarantee an open and free internet for all users. That's all that I have for now.
Thank you. And we do have public testimony still open. And off-net, we have Tom Brady. Mr. Brady, would you like to place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony, please?
Thank you, Chairman. This is Tom Brady. I work for Microcom in Anchorage. We do provide internet services via satellite through some national providers. And I do have some short testimony I'd like to enter. Basically, Mr. Chairman and committee, net neutrality is something that when the government tries to regulate an industry, they need to understand the technology they're trying to regulate to avoid unintended consequences. In this case, I'm kind of concerned that we're blaming poor internet service on the lack of net neutrality rules. Net neutrality, in its purest concept, is only possible when bandwidth is unlimited. If a service provider has unlimited bandwidth, they have no reason to prioritize one service over another. In Alaska, bandwidth, especially in rural Alaska, is limited. Service providers offer different speeds, different data caps at different prices, and many offer services that don't impact data caps on their networks. In other words, the market allocates the scarce resource of bandwidth based on what different consumers and, in some cases, content providers want to pay. It's this money that fuels the expansion of bandwidth. Technically, not all internet packets are equal. You know, this net neutrality statute would have to set up a structure that directs the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to adjudicate whether it is reasonable network management to prioritize some packets over others when the network itself is managed on a priority basis every day of the week. Or said another way, a service provider must prove that some of their packets are more equal than others, and it has the potential to result in continual litigation in front of the RCA until this is all sorted out. I would like to close by asking a few questions that I really don't know the answer to. Before net neutrality was imposed in 2015, were there any complaints about packets not being treated equally or fairly? After it was imposed, were there any complaints? Since it was reversed last December, have there been any complaints? Just what is the extent of the problem we are trying to solve? You know, our general lack of bandwidth in Alaska forces us to allocate resources today based on market demand. Doing away with the market-based allocation method and replacing it with a government-adjudicated allocation, you know, will again introduce this period of chaos until the government determines who gets to have what in what priority order. It will also slow down deployment of more bandwidth in the rural market since quality of service cannot be differentiated based on price. It can only be differentiated based on government's perception of need. That's my testimony for this morning or this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Do we have any questions for Mr. Brady? Seeing no questions, Representative Wool has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Brady?
Okay. Yes.
Sorry, I just had to comment on that. So 2015, what happened in 2015? I, you know, I thought the FCC currently regulated the overall internet, you know, the big internet in the whole country, as fairly neutral. In other words, an individual content provider couldn't get preferential treatment, or hence an individual content provider couldn't get deferential treatment. Isn't that the case right now? And what changed in 2015 that you're saying we should have been experiencing anything bad or worse since then?
In 2015, that is when the FCC imposed net neutrality first on the Internet. It's where they characterize it as a telecommunications service and not an information service. The concept of net neutrality didn't go anywhere until 2015, and it was repealed or reversed by the FCC in 2017.
That's your question, Representative Lazo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess so. It went from an information thing to a telecom regulated entity. But I guess my question is: prior to 2015, we still were considered net neutral, right? In other words, individual content providers couldn't pay more to have their content sped up, and relatively speaking, other providers were slowed or blocked or anything like that. I thought we had a neutral system, and that although the law was changed in 2017 by the FCC, it hasn't actually been enacted yet, and that's what this discussion is about, both at the state and federal level. Isn't that correct?
I do not think that's correct, because in 2015, when net neutrality was imposed by the FCC, there was no requirement that things be handled equally.
Thank you, Mr. Brady.
In other words, it was not, it technically was being operated as a neutral network, but there was no requirement it be operated as a neutral network.
Right.
Until 2015. Yeah. And then it was reversed by the FCC in December of last year.
And so Mr. Brady, for clarification, my understanding is that before 2015, there was no regulation, but there was concern that there could be some differential pricing schemes put in place. In 2015, there was an administrative order that restricted that opportunity. In 2017, the RCA repealed that order, so now we're back to pre-2015 that didn't have specific restrictions, but we had not actually seen any changes or restrictions to the way things had been operating up to that point. Is that a fair characterization, Mr. Brady?
The RCA was not involved in net neutrality.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I meant
the FCC was, and that would correct. Be the only difference. The question that I posed was there anything that happened before 2015 that was a problem? Was there anything that happened after 2015? And has anything happened since December?
And I think, Mr. Brady, just in general for the record on your question, my understanding is that there was concern that something would happen which necessitated or initiated the action in 2015 that made sure that nothing could happen, and then there was nothing that happened or didn't happen between 2015 and 2017, and now the rule has been removed. But there is now, again, concern that there might be some inequitable activity relating to Internet service.
Yes, I understand that. The question that I have in that is, since we sell services from a national provider, is if Alaska ends up being substantially regulated, substantially different than how that national provider runs their network, we run the risk of a national provider exiting Alaska where they're currently providing service, just simply because of the unique state regulation. We don't think that risk is worth the regulatory structure that it brings about.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Brady. We've got a question from Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Brady, for your testimony. It's good to hear from somebody that's actually in the field and working with this. My sense is, in trying to come up to speed with this, is that this is largely a federal issue, not really so much a local or a state issue, and primarily because from a federal standpoint, we don't want to really balkanize our communication system. We don't want to have different rules in Alaska than we have anyplace else, and it might actually drive competition out of the state if we try to throw something unique up here. But is your sense that this is largely a federal issue and dealt with at the federal level more appropriately?
I would, that would be my presumption all along. It's a federal issue, mainly because of the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. Is it would be impossible, for example, for AT&T Wireless to substantially manage their Alaska network any different than their network in Kansas. That would be onerous on them and probably be overturned at the federal level simply because it's impossible to implement.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Brady? Seeing no other questions, thank you for your testimony. We'll next go to OffNet George Pierce. Mr. Pierce and Kasilov, can you provide us with your name, affiliation, and give us your testimony, please?
Yes, my name is George Pierce. I'm representing myself and my wife. Net neutrality is about do we trust corporations and free markets to continue to act in the best interest to ensure consumers' best interests to the true internet freedom and neutrality as we have done for decades. Ask anybody in Alaska if they trust the federal government for anything, they're going to tell you no. I'm in favor of this bill. We need to return these protections back to the public to prevent internet providers like AT&T, or ACS or GCI using leverage, even though they said they wouldn't do that. But if competition comes in and that changes everything, money speaks. Everybody's buying everything off, so that's the issue. Our state depends on freedom of the internet. 60% of the people live in rural Alaska. We need to force companies to use internet neutrality in Alaska, nothing less. Why would our leaders allow to work for the best internet of Alaskans, allow ISPs to limit access to information, or to pay more to get what was offered and now we might pay? It was free before. Our free speech is on the internet, on the line here, and that's more important than pricing issues. If they control what we can say online, that's one step to silencing America's voices entirely. Restricted broadband to the internet is crucial to rural Alaskans' lifeline. We only need one vote, so you can tell the governor we're the one vote to keep it the way it is, not to change it. Thank you for taking my testimony, and I hope you guys do the right thing for us.
Thank you, Mr. Pierce. Any questions? We've got a question from Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Pierce, for your testimony this afternoon. I would just say, for one, I'm kind of glad the military's looking out for us in this state as far as one government entity. But specifically on your testimony, have you got any experience, personal experience in the problems with the internet as far as specifics, examples that we might refer to problems that
not yet, but if there's a problem, why do they want to change it? Netflix did.
So okay. I just we had a gentleman that testified before you asked if there's any complaints have been emanated, have shown up, and I personally haven't heard any, but I just was wondering if you had experienced.
So Netflix did.
Yep. Pardon me?
They shut it down until they changed it. Until they negotiated.
Mr. Pierce, could you repeat that answer, please?
They slowed it down, so they negotiate this. And I believe they're being, the FCC is being sued, I believe.
So you
investigate it anyway.
So through the chair, so you've had personal experience with internet slowdown occurring on in.
Yes, I have.
You have. Okay. Fair enough. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Pierce. We do have two people in the office signed up to testify. Jody Sparks. You want to come forward? Place your name and affiliation for the record and provide us with your testimony, please.
I want to thank the members of the committee and the chairman for letting me testify today. My name is Jody Sparks. I'm from Soldotna, Alaska. I'm here with Alaska Youth for Environmental Action. I'm a senior at Soldotna High School, and I'm here to urge you to support HB 277 because net neutrality is vital to ensuring internet connectivity in Alaska can remain fair and free. And when I was thinking about why I support net neutrality, I thought about all the things that the internet means for me as an Alaskan, as a youth, as a citizen of the U.S. I go online to study. I go online to research. I research this bill online, actually. I go online to relax, to shop, to interact with friends, and to meet all sorts of new viewpoints from around the world. The internet, to me personally, and to so many Alaskans, is vital. But I want to talk about how important it is to rural Alaska. My dad is a history teacher at Soldotna Prep School, and he runs a class where we teleconference. We've teleconferenced with places like Accra in Ghana, Ramal, Palestine, Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. And he does video conferences with rural schools. And personally, I've connected Port Graham with a student government conference that was going on at my school. And whenever we connect with these places that are off the road system, it's always so nice to see how important it is that these areas can have this connection to the outside world, to areas that they wouldn't get to see easily or maybe at all otherwise. The internet is so vital in Alaska for tele-education, for distance education, as we call it in our school. And it gives us so many more viewpoints and so many opportunities to experience what we otherwise wouldn't. So I urge you to support net neutrality. And just a few facts about the principle itself and what happened. When the current administration came into power and proposed changes to net neutrality, polls were taken, and nationwide there was 83% disapproval of the new proposal. Which is, there is 83% approval of net neutrality when presented with both arguments. And as to net neutrality being a federal issue versus a state issue, Montana, there was an executive action by the governor of Montana to provide net neutrality for that state. And I believe today the governor of Washington signed a law that created a net neutral state for the state of Washington. So thank you for listening to my testimony.
And thank you. We've got a question from Representative Knott.
So, Jody, you said your dad's teaching at what school?
Soldotna Prep School.
Soldotna Prep. That put Skyview or Soldotna, or it's right in Soldotna, isn't it?
He was at Skyview, and when the consolidation happened.
So, to the chair, so my question is, in all your research, besides Montana, and you're correct, Washington just passed it, did you find any other states that are taking action on this? You know, the industry argues that it's better off regulated at a national level, not individual states. You said doing business across state lines is complicated if you have every state setting a different set of rules. And I kind of understand that argument in a sense. So my question is, in all your research, it's probably a little early yet to detect any problems in the system, but that is a question. And also, have you seen other states other than two you mentioned taking any action?
To the chairman, specifically, I don't know of other states, but it was in December that the new rules that repealed net neutrality happened, so it is still pretty early, and I know there's talk among it has a lot of popular support nationwide, so I'm expecting future actions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I just want to commend you for being here and testifying, and thank you for your effort and initiative. You had indicated that there's currently in your personal experience some very good effort at broadcasting outside of Alaska educational curriculum. And I guess what I guess the follow-up, you know, there would be, have you noticed any willful or intentional slowing down of bandwidth or anything that looks to be, you know, kind of suspicious, or have you found the capability and the quality of service to be satisfactory in your view?
Through the chairman, again, being that it was only appealed 3 months ago, industry has not, as of yet, taken action to slow down, to create those sorts of situations, but I personally don't have faith in, without these rules, in industries self-regulating and doing what's best for the consumer rather than the industry.
Okay, so no specific examples, just a fear of what might, the potential of what might happen then.
Not personally, but yeah. And no.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we have Kristen Kelly. Ms. Kelly, if you want to come forward, place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony, please.
Sorry. My name is Kirsten Kelly, and I'm from Palmer. I'm also here with Alaska Youth for Environmental Action. I'm here in support of House Bill 277. Most communities throughout Alaska only have one option as an internet service provider, and when faced with the challenge of only having one option, that creates a potential for self-regulation to not occur within internet service providers. We see self-regulation in other things, and that can happen because it's not a monopoly. However, in many communities in Alaska, it's a monopoly, so the company can kind of do what they want and have more leeway, and that is a huge concern to me because in a lot of communities, the internet is the main source of information. The schools provide internet for the students, especially in villages, and they use that internet as their means for a lot of online classes, and a lot of learning takes place online. And when it comes down to it, I really do not have faith that companies will continue to follow net neutrality without some kind of regulation, because they are there for the money and the profit, and they are going to be willing to put that over consumers. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you as well for testifying here. I'm actually, we have property in the Matsu, and I'm an MTA customer, and they provide great bandwidth, so I have security cameras up there because stuff keeps getting stolen. So I've got MTA, a service provider, and I also receive at GCI and AT&T in, you know, whether I'm Juneau and Anchorage. But it strikes me that there's a lot of competition out there, and that if you are, in fact, unhappy with MTA, that you can walk across the street, presumably, and find somebody else. So, I mean, it generally in our economy, if you know, competition is a good thing. In other words, it improves services. It makes consumers go find the best deal. From your experience, have you experienced anything or seen anything that indicates willful slowdown, or where an internet service provider saying, "Well, I'm really gonna screw down the service quality here, so to make my customer unhappy"? Have you ever run into that or heard of that in any case? Because that's what I was kind of looking for.
No, I have not. But it was also such a recent repeal of those regulations that I think it's going to take some time for it to take effect.
Okay.
Or for us to thank feel you. The effects.
Great. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, thank you for your Representative Bull.
Thank you,
question.
Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming and testifying. And I'm not sure if this question is for you or the bill sponsor or somebody, but I just need a point of clarification from somebody. And I know the FCC and Chair Ajit Pai just recently, their commission voted 3-2, I guess, to overturn net neutrality. But it's my understanding that hasn't happened yet. So any kind of, have you noticed this or have you noticed that? we're in status quo position, and maybe someone can correct me. I thought we're still in hold, that these kind of throttling down, and I think it's not an overall sort of pipe of internet, it's individual content within that pipe. So, you know, Netflix might go faster than, say, you know, Betflix or, you know, Letflix or some other Flix that is not paying as much as Netflix to this, to you know, Viacom or something. So, and maybe someone can speak to this. My understanding is that we are still in a net neutral world that hasn't really changed for all intents and purposes since the inception of the internet. So, any comparison is moot, I think, at this point. Maybe someone can speak to that.
Representative Will, I think, thank you, Ms. Kelly. I think that's actually a question for the bill sponsor. And Mr. Garish, if you can come forward and answer Representative Will's question.
For the record, this is Jacob Garish, staff representative Scott Kawasaki again. The order has not gone into effect yet. It had to first be delivered to Congress, and then it had to be entered in the Federal Register, and then there's a 60-day waiting period while the Congressional Review Act could happen. So I think it's April 23rd that the order will finally
begin. Okay, appreciate that clarification. Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that helps me a lot. So any sort of comparison to then and now is really a it's only just then is now. So I guess my question is this. As a bill, as a statewide bill, and obviously this is more of a federal FCC-type issue, do you see this bill as a symbolic gesture to showing that Alaska takes this stand, along with other states that may take this stand, as a message to Congress? Or is this something that, if enacted, you know, the pipe of internet coming up to Alaska via somewhere on a fiber optic cable, that if it's throttled down in different ways, that somehow you just don't want additional throttling at the state level? Is that what it is, or is this more of a symbolic, or can you answer that?
I don't think I feel comfortable answering the intent of the bill for the representative, but it may have both effects.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One, you know, the FTC, as I understand it, the FTC managed, through the chair, the FTC managed the internet, if you will, from 1996 to 2015. From 2015 to 2017, for a couple of years, they threw it over, they moved it over to the FCC, which is the, you know, the had previously managed, you know, utilities and those sort of things. And then it just recently went back to the FTC. So the bulk of the growth and the positive impact the internet has had, as I interpret it, has happened since from 1996 to present, has largely been under the regulatory regime control and oversight of the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, which also has teeth and can also manage and ensure competition. And it's only for 2 years out of, you know, since 1996 that it was through the FCC, which kind of threw it into the utility bailiwick and having the government decide, you know, who gets what in the way of a bandwidth allocation. Now it's back into a commercial market. And I was just, is that your understanding as well, through the chair, that it's largely been an FCC that's had oversight of the, you know, kind of the internet and how it's regulated for the most of that period?
Through the chair to Representative Birch, that's actually not my understanding. In 1996, that was when the distinction between Title I and Title II services was first made. Since then, the standard for regulation of the internet has been for net neutrality, and there's been cases where companies have been caught slowing down services. I know that in 2007, Comcast was caught slowing down a service known as BitTorrent, and when that happened, the FCC actually issued an order for Comcast to stop the throttling. So I think that the FCC has been regulating
FCC
right. since before 2015. Right. Yeah. So they've been regulating the FCC throughout. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Garish. Any other questions? Seeing none, I don't have anybody else signed up. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 277? Pardon? So you have somebody else added on? No. Oh, Bean. Okay, new person. We do have a new person who has signed up, Ms. Pierce from Kasiloff. If you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony, please.
Hi, my name is Jeannie Pierce. I'm calling from Kasiloff, and I'm representing myself. I only called in because I heard you guys ask all the people if it's affected them. Well, it has affected Netflix, so that means it has affected everybody. Until they negotiated, which they did, with the FCC, or they negotiated, it did slow down the lines. Now, from what I'm reading, this bill is not even implemented until April 30th, so you're really not going to see anything changed yet. You see what I'm saying here? You're not going to see much change until April 30th. But Netflix was slowed down, so that means everybody that got Netflix was slowed down. So, yes, we were slow. So I'm in favor of this bill. We are one vote away, and we need to send a message. We need to keep the protections that we had and not hand this over to government, because we know how we all feel about government. So I'm for this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Pierce. Any
thank
questions?
You.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't have anybody else on? Okay. Don't have anybody else signed up for public testimony. With that, I will close public testimony at 4:30. That brings the bill back before us for discussion. Any comments on House Bill 277? I am going to make a comment. I don't have an objection to moving this bill from committee, but I do think that we are at the very esoteric and theoretical end of legislation, because we are trying to address something that has technically not really happened, and I do not know if this is the correct vehicle to actually address that question, because it does seem like kind of an esoteric question that is out there waiting for the federal government to do something. We don't know which yet. But I do think we do need to make sure that we have equitable access to broadband, equitable access to content on the internet, and I do think the concept of net neutrality is a concept that we need to be supporting, and I will not hold this bill up, but I'm not exactly sure if this bill actually resolves that concept. So we have a comment from Representative Josephson, Wool, and then Birch.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Something happened in December 2017 with the ruling in 17-108 and relative to internet speed and net neutrality. There was a reason for the FCC's ruling, obviously, and I think it's viewed, broadly speaking, is an effort to raise out of the private sector to make money. It's designed to alter an equal playing field and move us in a different direction. And for that reason, I support the bill. I think I agree with you, Mr. Chairman, that I don't. I think at this point the bill acts more like a resolution than a bill. And I'm okay for the purpose of moving the bill out of committee. But I'm not quite sure how, because of federal commerce powers and because of the logistics of the internet, I'm not quite sure how a state can interfere with sort of the national or international internet system. So I don't pretend to understand the mechanics of that, but I do think that something profound happened on December 14th last year, and it was an effort to commercialize the internet, which obviously is a commercial enterprise to begin with, but this is a different tilt, and so I'm going to support a motion to move the bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Wool, and then go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair, I guess I echo your sentiments. I think if you like the way the internet's been working since we've all known it, then you probably don't want to change it. And I think what happened at the FCC in December could potentially change it a lot. And I sort of thought about the analogy of a road where, you know, you can change the speed limit of a road, and that might be if someone pays more for a faster internet service or doesn't pay faster. But I think what this change at the FCC will do will tell you how fast each individual car can drive on that road, and I wouldn't want to see that, because I don't want to see people squeezed out or that they would have to pay more to be noticed. So I'm not sure of the efficacy of a bill over a resolution. I know there is a resolution as well, and maybe sending the signal to Congress is what we're trying to do. But as the concept of the bill, I support.
Thank you, Representative Birch.
Yeah, I object to moving us forward. I think we've heard enough testimony, and there's even enough uncertainty on this panel about what this really does and what's intended to do. I worry about the risk. I worry about the risk of competition is a good thing, but if you have a service provider that's we had testimony that some service providers may only have 1,500 broadband customers in Alaska out of perhaps a million nationwide. Are they going to try to curtail and revamp their services to address that very small market? Maybe not. I mean, we've witnessed Walmart has closed. I drive by an empty Walmart building in this town periodically. We've seen other other stores move out when it's just not economic. I think we need to make sure that we're running that we have an environment here that attracts the kind of investment that's necessary to ensure that the consumers have the a choice. That consumers have a choice. I mentioned earlier. I have basically three service providers, and I think that benefit and that opportunity is good for consumers. I'm concerned that we have we're presenting here a kind of a solution, run around looking for a problem. I don't think we have a problem with the internet. I think net neutrality is kind of, it appears to me to be kind of a ginned up deal. It's basically should be a federal issue, and I think we're spending a lot of time on it here, and I think we ought to just let it rest. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sullivan Leonard, and then Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I echo my colleague's comments there regarding just the oversight for the network companies. I think truly FCC has worked very hard to address issues that have come to light in the last 20 years with regard to internet usage, throttle process. I actually don't see that happening, but I haven't seen proof of that. And the other thing, too, is you don't want each state then to have particular rules in place that then stops the network management processes that are in place that the FCC has also negotiated with these companies to have in place. I think part of what we're seeing here is kind of a fear factor, if you will, and I don't operate like that. I like facts, I like figures, and I like knowing what's happening before me to not have it based on emotion. We understand that things will be happening in the next couple months. Let's wait and see how things work on the federal side before taking action on something that is as important as this. So I will not support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's pretty much all been said already. Not much more I can add to it, but I do like the net neutrality concept. That's what we're used to. It's worked well for all of us. I agree with Representative Birch that, we're kind of, it hasn't been a problem yet. We might be heading off a problem, but we don't know this one even exists. So my preference would be to wait till we actually have a problem, I think, to address it. I'm not quite sure, but Mr. Chairman, you gotta wonder. We've been all used to, we'll say, equal treatment across the internet, but if you're in commerce and your goal is to sell speed and services, and as the gentleman testified, a lot of our limitations is in the broadband width, So shouldn't industry have a right to market their product, in that sense? So I question that, and right now we don't have any of that in front of us. So if I was an internet service provider, provided services, would I not have that right to sell things faster for quicker service? I don't know the answer to that, but it hasn't been an issue, and I'm afraid to address this one. So I'm not going to support moving out of committee. I support the net neutrality concept because what I'm used to, it's worked pretty well. I'm not sure if it went the other way that it wouldn't work well as well. I don't think to those of us as consumers or users that we would feel it as much as the commercial services being provided. I'd rather have a direct problem in front of me to address, and I'm just speculating like everybody else at this point. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to say this. I don't pay the top amount for my internet service. I don't get the fastest I can get. I could pay more and get faster, more bandwidth, all that stuff. I don't. But they're all ratcheted down equally. And if I pay more, they're all ratcheted up equally. So individual, like if I go to contractorbuilder.com, I have the same access as I do to, you know, another site. But I just worry that if given the ability, they will get manipulated. And in Fairbanks, where I live, I basically have option of one provider. So I support this net neutrality concept.
With that, Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move HB 277 version 30-LS1213/D be passed from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
And I am assuming there are objections, so we will take a vote, Madam Secretary.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Wall.
Yes.
Representative Birch?
No.
Representative Knopf?
No.
Representative Sullivan Leonard?
No.
Representative Stutz?
Yes.
Chair Keto?
Yes. So with four votes for, three votes against the motion, or the bill has moved from the House Labor and Commerce Committee, now goes on to the House Finance Committee. With that, we'll take a brief at ease to sign our paperwork. Thank you. We are back on the record in House Labor and Commerce at 4:44 p.m. And at this time, I do have a committee substitute to House Bill 309. Representative Guttenberg's staff will introduce the bill, but because I do want to present and not have any concerns about my position regarding my chairmanship of this committee, I'm going to step down, make my presentation, probably not a whole lot of time to get much into that beyond the presentation, but then would be available at our next meeting. So at this time, Representative Birch, I will abstain from voting as well. I'll leave decision up to the committee. The first, and I'll talk about that when I get up to the dais. So at this time, 3:45 p.m.
We reserve the right to object to your abstaining. Can we reserve the right to?
You can. Okay. Yes,
I'd like to do that.
Okay. So at this time, 3:45 p.m., I will turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Representative Wool, and then we will begin.
Thank you, Chair Keto. I will note it's 4:45 p.m. And
he wishes it was
3:45. If you want to begin your testimony.
For the record, my name is Aliana Salangit, staff to Representative Guttenberg. He is stuck in House Finance right now, so I'll be introducing House Bill 309. Representative Guttenberg introduced this bill because he was primarily concerned with the process leading up to the final recommendations. He believes the State Officer Compensation Commission was enacted to depoliticize legislators' salaries, but when listening to the meetings, that wasn't done. It was a very political conversation. He believes the recommendations should be further analyzed to see what the actual impacts are. And additionally, these recommendations fail to meet the Commission's statutory obligations in Section 39.23.580. It states that the Commission must recommend an equitable rate and form of compensation, benefits, and allowances for legislators. So he believes it does not. This recommendation does not meet that.
Thank you, Aliana.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Birch, do you have a question?
Yeah, I guess if it's a question, I'd just be a question of the sponsor, since the sponsor's not here. Just for my own understanding, is the only issue that's in play here is the per diem for Juneau area legislators? Is that the primary driver here through the chair?
This is a question for the bill sponsor.
Through the chair, his primary concern is the process leading up to that decision. But yes, the final recommendation was their recommendations only affects legislators within 50 miles of their resident.
Follow up. So just to clarify, the only issue that's at play here, the only distinction, the reason it's a process question or whatever, has got to do with the fact that Juneau area legislators were, or I should say anybody within 50 miles of where they reside would not receive per diem as a legislator.
That was a result of the findings, but again, he was primarily concerned with the conversations and process leading up to it. There wasn't enough data, fact, and figures in the conversation.
Okay,
it was more political.
Just wanted to understand what it is we're kind of talking about with all these substitutes and everything.
It might clarify things if we move the CS for the purposes of discussion, and then we can open up a little bit. Unless Representative Knopf, you have a question.
Mr. Chair, my question really pertains to the initial bill in front of us, not the substitutes. So I'd like to ask a question to the sponsor before we roll the substitute, because it takes a different. And I want to agree with you. The first ruling from the Compensation Committee I felt was completely arbitrary, and no way would have supported that. But they come back with this was the second go around at it. And I didn't necessarily find it to be arbitrary in the sense, for me, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that what they did was just implement the 50-mile radius rule. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it affected our local legislators here and would also affect any legislator if session was held or special session somewhere else. So I guess my question, Mr. Chairman, is how do we still feel it's arbitrary in nature, they're ruling the second go-around?
Through the chair, I would urge Representative Knopf to listen to the January 17th hearing. I believe that's what Representative Guttenberg would say in this situation.
I did listen to some of the meetings, and okay, good enough. Thank you.
So I suggest we have a motion, and we can discuss the CS, which may answer some of the questions that are going around. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the committee adopt the CS for House Bill 309, version 30-LS1228/J as the working document. And I'd like to note for the record, I take no position on the CS, but I move that it be treated as the working document.
And I'll object for the purposes of discussion. And if we can explain the changes, we have Representative Keto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will acknowledge, a couple of the things going into this. This is basically my work. It's not committee's work. It's not Representative Guttenberg's work. It is an effort I did as I went through and started trying to figure out what the Salary Compensation Commission had done and how they got to their decisions. And so in that analysis, I did some reviews in various areas, and I've got a brief PowerPoint presentation. My goal, I hope, is to be able to get that PowerPoint presentation accomplished or finished by 5 p.m. this evening. If not, then we can continue it at a next meeting or at another meeting. It is a little bit longer, but I can go through quite a few of the pieces fairly quickly. So right now we do have a variety of compensation methods in our country. Our situation is a commission acts unless vetoed or basically rejected by the legislature, and that is the same as a few other states: Hawaii, Arizona, Montana, North Dakota, Wisconsin, and Missouri. And so there are other states that have different methods. Some salaries are tied to an index, where the commission actually sets the salaries. It doesn't create a change in statute that has a veto operation. There are many states that have no commission or inactive. Actually, a little less than half the states don't actually have any kind of a commission established for establishing compensation. And this graph comes from the National Conference of State Legislatures. The Alaska Officers Compensation Commission was authorized under Alaska Statute 39. It was passed as a House Bill 417 during the 25th Alaska Legislature in 2008. The statute had a compensation commission that had been active in the past, but it hadn't been active for quite some time until this bill was updated. 2009 was the first issued report of this iteration of the Officers' Compensation Commission, and that report recommended that legislators' salary be set at $50,400, that an additional $500 be allowed for the President of the Senate and Speaker of the House, and that per diem office expenses and moving expenses to be set by legislative council. That was all within the 2009 report. 2011, there was a recommendation to increase the salaries of the governor from $125,000 to $145,000, lieutenant governor from $100,000 to $115,000. This recommendation was not rejected, so that is where the governor and lieutenant governor sit right now. In 2014, a recommended increase to salaries for governor, lieutenant governor, and department heads was rejected. It was proposed as an increase recognizing the inflation, effects of inflation, and the cost of living. Those recommendations were rejected by the legislature and signed by the governor. Currently, the Officers' Compensation Commission recommended initially over the history of the ASOC, the Alaska Salary or State Officers' Compensation Commission, they've recommended increases for governor and lieutenant governor on two occasions and for department heads on one occasion. 2017 was the first time since the establishment of the commission in 2009 that there were any recommendations relating to the legislature, and that went through a series of different recommendations until, as Representative Knopf was asking, or Representative Birch was asking, the actual recommendation to the legislature this time around was only for the reduction of the balance of the per diem cost that the, in effect, the judo legislators or the legislators within 50 miles of the convening location were located.
Representative Guido.
Yes.
You had mentioned that the Ledge Council recommends per diem, but the Compensation Commission chose to reduce the Juneau legislators' compensation.
Correct. So what happened in that situation is in 2009, the Compensation Commission said, we believe that per diem should be in the hands of legislative council. We will not be addressing that. And that was the only recommendation regarding per diem for the Compensation Commission until 2017. So statutorily, they have the authority to look at all sources of compensation for the legislature, but only for their salaries for the department heads, the governor and lieutenant governor.
Question. Representative Birch.
You've used the word compensation as it relates to per diem, which is, for those of us that move down here for the session, it kind of covers the cost. But do you use those interchangeably, or you view the per diem payment the proportional rate of per diem that is attributed to currently for legislators within 50 miles of the convening location, you view that as compensation?
Through the chair, I actually just get into that further on in the PowerPoint presentation. I don't, looking at the time, believe we're going to have time to actually get to that point, so we'll have to continue that discussion when we get there, but I will try and get through a few other slides before we wrap up the meeting tonight. So basically what I wanted to say is in 10 years of existence, Compensation Commission has failed to engage in a periodic review of legislative compensation. However, on two occasions, it has made recommendations to executive compensation. Equitable compensation is where I get into that next discussion. Right now, and this is where we are currently, and the sheets that you see on the right are not meant to be readable. Those are included in your packets. It's just an illustration, and the details are over on the left of the slide. Basically, right now, our base salary is $50,400. Per diem is based on the federal short-term per diem rate. Relocation expenses are provided. Travel per diem is provided. And when you add up for our basic level of base compensation plus per diem for a 90-day session, a legislator that does not live in Juneau currently at a base receives about $75,150 for 90 days of legislative session. And because of the Juneau 75% of per diem. Juneau base is 68,692.5. And those are budgeting numbers. And so basically what that acknowledges is some amount of the per diem, as Representative Birch had asked the question of, is technically or actually compensation as opposed to actual per diem or relocation or residential or non-residential living expenses. And so just to finish this slide up, all legislators, we budget about $4.5 million for a 90-day legislative session, and that's kind of where we're at right now.
Representative Sullivan-Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kito, as you've kind of gone over quite a bit of research here, my understanding is that how our dollars are figured out comes from, is it Department of Defense? Is that correct? And then it comes to each state, and that's how they make their determination on how much our per diem should be, the per diem rate. And then also, second question is, have those numbers then come to the Ledge Council's consideration on a yearly basis, so that way you could kind of keep a tracking mechanism of those per diem charges?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan-Leonard, our per diem for the legislature is adopted by legislative council, but since the initial determination and a policy that was adopted by legislative council, and I don't have that immediately at my fingertips, but it did come out in my research, shortly after this was passed, either 2010 or 2011, a motion was made in legislative council that established or adopted the federal short-term rate as the per diem rate for non-Juneau legislators, and Juneau legislators were adopted at 0.75 times that federal rate. There's nothing in the record that explains what or why or how that that amount was, or that type of per diem, or that list was adopted. Basically, it was adopted by the legislature, okay, and hasn't been adjusted since.
Just quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Okay, I can understand that. Part of my research has also been to look at the Department of Defense, and I guess what I'm trying to gather is, did Ledge Council look at this on a yearly basis, or only look at this when the compensation commission then brought it to your attention that they wanted to make changes?
The legislative council has addressed per diem as in under my tenure as a presentation that was made to the entire legislative council back in April, I believe, of last year. That information is available online, but we did bring up the discussion, and I think we are running out of time. Rather than start getting into some of the options, what I'll do is go ahead and pause here before getting into some more of the detail of the issues that I had wanted to put forward.
Thank you, Representative Kito. I have a question from Representative Birch. Before we get to that, just one quick question. The Juneau-based legislators are getting 0.75 of the federal short-term rate. However, for Juneau legislators, that tax is paid on it as if it was income, whereas non-Juneau legislators, it's tax-free. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. So in Juneau, because we are living in Juneau, that is actually counted in our base as taxable income. And so I received that 0.75% as taxable income or regular compensation.
Thank you. So it could be thought of as compensation in that way. Representative Birch.
I was just going to, through the chair, just make the observation that when we looked at the special session, were we to meet in Anchorage, over half of the legislature would receive no per diem at significant savings, and Juneau area legislators and legislators from outside of Anchorage would receive the full federal rate without taxes. So just as an observation that if we're looking at significant, you know, making savings, that's one opportunity.
Through the chair, though, what I'd like to say is that actually was calculated
laid it out for a special session, and it was determined that even though half the legislators would not have to travel, the short-term federal per diem rate in Anchorage is significantly higher than Juneau, which actually resulted in a 30-day special session in Anchorage costing more than a special session in Juneau.
But follow up. I don't want to litigate the Anchorage versus Juneau
no, I think
special
the
session
was
right now. But
that they assumed that everybody that lived in Anchorage would collect per diem, if I remember the calculation right. Yeah, that's right.
Well, I don't want to relitigate that that whole decision that we went through last special session or two ago. But I know that the Anchorage per diem was in the middle of summer up to $400 a day. Representative.
No, because of your admonishment, your advisement.
Representative Kanata.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's not a question. It's just a quick comment to Representative Sullivan Leonard. In fact, Department of Defense does determine the per diem rate. It is adjusted twice annually. And we usually address it as we go into session. Ledge Council usually addresses it, picks up the new rate. It's moved up and down over the years. But they do adopt a 30-day rate, a 60-day rate, then a longer-term rate. And it's on a chart that's provided to us, and that's – But Mr. Chairman, the point of that is Department of Defense does this all over the state, and they adjust per diem rates for every single community in the state twice annually, and that is why, just for the sponsor of this bill, that I never supported the Compensation Committee looking at per diems, because they don't have the resources that are utilized in that research and them charts prepared to us to look at them cost of living. So just for the record on that.
Well, obviously, this is a live and active debate. It's a topic we'd like to talk about, and I think we will adjourn this meeting at 5:03. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 9th at 3:15. We will do confirmation hearings of Commissioner Mike Navarre, boards and commissions, HB 326, naturopaths, licensing practice, and HB 89, licensed radiologic nuclear medicine technologists. And we will gavel out and resume this bill in the near future, I'm sure. Thank you.
Thank you.